This is a podcast from The Times.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 107. Of the Bugle, of podcast for people with lungs. That's a nice catch-all tagline for us. With me, Andy Zaltzman, here in the city where once upon a time, Winston Churchill used to wake up in the morning, stretch his index finger and his middle fingers, give them a real full-digit workout, just in case you needed them later that day, either for flipping a V-sign towards continental Europe, or for smoking a particularly wriggly cigar or snake, or for about a finger wrestling against Lord Halifax to determine what Britain should do next in the war. That's London, in case there's any confusion. And in the Big Apple, so called because it's full of maggots and has a tendency to be tasteless, and is the perfect and is perfect with blackcurrants in a crumble. That's New York. It's John, the Chunter Hunter, Oliver.
Andy, get the f*** out of here. Hello, Andy. Hello, hello. Buglers.
Hello.
I'm in the brand new studio this week, Andy, built incredibly quickly by 100,000 slave labourers from ancient Egypt. Hold on. I'm not thinking about the studio. I'm thinking about the pyramids. I meant built by Paul, here with his own sweat and tears, not with a single ancient Egyptian slave, as far as I know. And he could have done that. It would have dramatically cut cost in the process, but he didn't. And here it is, Andy. It's magnificent, built to last a lifetime, and until the 20th century was the tallest structure on Earth for centuries. Hold on, I'm talking about the pyramids again. My mistake. But it's built for the Bugle, Andy. These walls are going to see some fresh bullshit over the coming months.
And you're just talking about the pyramids again.
I just hope that Paul has built them strong enough to handle it.
I just hope that in 3,000 years' time someone digs you up and wonders what you were doing there. Well, this is Bugle 107. 107, incidentally, the number that Franklin D. Roosevelt would always count to when playing hide-and-seek with his wife, Eleanor. Why 107, you ask? No reason other than that he liked a bit of peace and quiet. Found his wife a little irritating. And his extensive research into the matter found that 107 was the highest number he could get to before Eleanor started thinking he was taking a piss. And this is for the week beginning Monday, the 15th of March, 2010. And as all Julius Caesar fans will know to their cost, 15th of March, the Ides of March, John. And on this day in 44 BC, or 2051 BB, that's before Bugle, Julius copped the big one, stabbed to death by his buddies who gathered around him and treated him like a bowl of olives with a lot of toothpicks. 1493, on this day, Christopher Columbus arrived back from his first trip to the Americas. All right, CC, said Spanish King Ferdinand when he arrived back. What have you got for me? Don't tell me you've been on holiday for 6 months and haven't got me a present. Yep, Ferdo, of course I got you something, said Columbus. I got you this. A key ring? That's your key ring. I saw you leave with that when you left 6 months ago. Are you taking the piss? Yeah, of course, that was your joke present. This is your real present. Thanks, Chris, I'll unwrap it. Oh, it's a T-shirt with the slogan, My Explorer Went to the Caribbean and Discovered a New Continent, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. You piece of... Got you again, said Columbus. He said, frantically scanning his ship for something else to give the king. This is your present. Wow, said King Ferdinand. A group of indigenous natives. Cool. Wait till I show this to King John of Portugal. He's going to be so jealous. Awesome, dude. Anything else? Yeah, I got this terrific little disease. Syphilis. It's a beaut. I think it's going to do really well in Europe. Let me tell you, this disease has got it. It's going to be the fashionable way to die this season. Hell yeah. Let's spread it.
Run, Tom. Run. Leave me here. Save yourself, Tom. This, of course, is a special Bugle.
Yeah, very special.
It's a sad end. This is Tom's last Bugle. He's been with us from the beginning. And I do like to think that this podcast, in some small way, helped drive him out of the British Isles into the Southern Hemisphere, where he currently hangs upside down on the bottom of the planet somewhere under my feet.
It's where you belong.
Like a criminal. If you're an emotional criminal and you've been exiled to Australia.
Through a combination of overrunning and irritation... you've driven me into exile. You've broken me.
Oh, dear.
It's not you I'm worried about. It's your English daughter growing up in Australia that I'm concerned about.
Andy, for the record, she is Australian now.
I do hope, Tom, that Andy and I will live on in your subconscious as the embodiment of irritation.
Done and done.
And to mock Tom's emigration, and departure from the Bugle, we have an international property section in which we take a look at the worst value properties on the world market, including a luxury six-bedroom family igloo in tropical Brazil. The London Meat House, made entirely out of meat scraps, bit of a tendency to putrefy on a hot day, and Norman Foster's iconic new floating plankton yacht, part house, part come-and-eat-me plea to endangered whales.
It's a Bugle special this week. Ethics. It's not just an English county next to Thuffolk. Boom! Boom!
Can I do my version of that joke, John?
Okay.
Ethics. Now, to most politicians and businessmen, ethics is just a county cricket team that used to be really good in the 80s.
Boom, 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 boom!
There you go!
That joke has been officially milked dry now. This week's Bugle is indeed a tribute to all those brave men and women who work tirelessly, dedicatedly, and for only their own massive personal profit to put the violations into ethics violations. And this has been a great week for ethics scandals, Andy. It seems that we humans are really crystallising now the most effective techniques for how to completely demean ourselves as a species. A truly memorable ethics violation is a thing of beauty. It's a work of art. It must have that perfect balance of a large element of hypocrisy, an undertone of arrogance, and maybe the occasional dash of sexual assault for flavour. And someone who...
Sounds like a night out with you, John.
And someone who mastered this recipe recently was Congressman Eric Masser of New York's 29th District. Hold your head up high, Eric, and now hang it down in shame. He resigned on Monday under the cloud of an ethics probe, having been accused of groping three of his staffers. But that is just the tip of his extremely tawdry iceberg. All kinds of male sexual assaults dating back to his time in the Navy are now emerging around the married father of three. It's also not a charge he particularly denies. He went on Glenn Beck's hourly pulpit bonanza on Tuesday, defending himself by saying, "Not only did I grope a staffer, I tickled him until he couldn't breathe, and then four men jumped on top of me. It was my 50th birthday." First off, it sounds like Masser was under the misapprehension that the staffer involved had a particularly ticklish penis. And also, that is not, unless I'm horrifically mistaken, a 50th birthday tradition. You get to pick someone in the room, tickle them to the point of asphyxiation, and then four other men will pile on. There's no better way to say goodbye to your 40s.
Yeah, facing an ethics probe following alleged sexual harassment of a younger male member of staff, and ironically, member of staff is the nickname Masser uses for his Django Badango. And he's admitted also that he used language that he described as salty, which is pretty vague, but yeah. I guess kind of expressive.
Yeah.
He said, "I did use language in the privacy of my own home and in my inner office that after 24 years in the Navy might make a chief petty officer feel uncomfortable." Crumbs, the mind boggles. What could he mean? Could he have said, "Holy shit, there's a torpedo about to hit our ship"? If I was a chief petty officer, that would make me feel pretty uncomfortable. As would, "Hey, fellas, let's liven things up and see if we can ram that iceberg." Or even, "That Japanese pilot looks like he doesn't know where he's going. This isn't an airport. What a nitwit."
Perhaps the best detail of this whole story concerned Rahm Emanuel, the famously foul-mouthed White House chief of staff, who Masser claims confronted him in the congressional gym showers over his refusing to vote on the presidential healthcare bill. He said, "I'm sitting there showering, naked as a jaybird, and here comes Rahm Emanuel, not even with a towel, his finger in my chest, yelling at me because I wasn't going to vote for the president's budget." Masser said, "You know how awkward it is to have a political argument with a naked man." I don't know that, Andy, but I'm guessing that the answer is extremely awkward.
I think it depends, John. It's one of the fundamental questions of human life. How awkward is it to have a political argument with a naked man? What? You know, that goes back to the very start of humanity. You know, Adam and Eve probably wasn't that awkward.
Uh-huh.
You know,
true.
You can just imagine it. True. Adam saying, "Well, I just think democracy is a needless luxury in a world with a population of two, love. Now put that apple down and stop talking to snakes." But, you know, if you're having a... It also depends who you're having the argument with, John. Hitler, for example.
Right.
I'd guess any political argument with Hitler is awkward, whether he was wang in or wang out.
Uh-huh.
I guess in a way it's probably harder to keep a straight face if he was in the... probably harder to keep a straight face if he was in the Nazi buff, as he used to get quite animated talking about politics, and he must have, well, had a bit of bounce and flop whilst he was banging on about stuff. Also, I guess, depends on your attitude towards nudity. I mean, the Swedes right. probably think nothing of having a political discussion in the Raw. They probably think it's odd to talk about anything with clothes on, in fact. And also depends on the location. You know, in a sauna or a right. nudist beach, you probably just forget about the nudity after a bit. But more awkward in a more formal, traditional political setting, like the Houses of Parliament. I mean, why do you think British MPs voted for the Corn Laws in the 19th century? It's because then Prime Minister Lord Liverpool started stripping off until people agreed with him. Or the UN. Now, I think Chavez is the man to put this to the test, John.
Oh, yeah.
I can think of no more appropriate naked man to launch a political discussion at the UN than Chavez. I want to find out if his balls are anti-American too.
That would be great. Chavez just walking naked up to the podium and the first word out of his mouth being, "What?"
Because it also depends on what you're discussing, John.
True.
Whether, yeah, how awkward it is. If it's whether or not underpants should be punitively taxed, it might be appropriate. You know, whether or not willies should have the vote, similarly. But how to legislate against illegal sex trafficking, that would look bad.
But I guess under my modern British repressed standard, Andy, it sounds excruciatingly awkward. But the problem is it also sounds funny enough to know that you couldn't really relay that anecdote in an interview and expect people not to find it hysterical. And apparently, interestingly, quite a lot of business gets done in the Congressional Gym, and perhaps this butt-naked bipartisan summit should be continually encouraged. If Congress cannot get a piece of legislation moving clothed, they should have to do it naked, waps and wangs waggling in the wind. It might stop the kind of political grandstanding that's poisoning both houses at the moment. It's a well-known fact that people are 84% less pompous when they're naked. And 62% more horny! Because if you think about it, Andy, the ancient Greeks got a lot done because they did most of their legislating when in the bath together. You see a whole new side of someone. I'm telling you, Andy, naked Congress. It'll help Washington work much more effectively and will make the State of the Union address unmissable television. Furthermore, any nervous president will not have to try to picture everyone naked because they'll already be that way.
God, it's probably lucky that didn't apply when Clinton was in charge. Otherwise, he'd have been standing some way back from his podium. Now, but what was interesting was that after this story about being jabbed in the chest by a naked Rahm Emanuel, Massa's interlocutor on the radio show said, "Surely that's sexual harassment." What? Poking someone angrily in the chest while telling them to vote for something? That just screams, "I want to make love to you!"
It depends what you're poking them with. Finally, in response to the allegations emerging from Massa's time in the Navy, including so-called meat-watching and snorkelling, please don't look either of those up. Do yourself a favour and resist the temptation to look either of those up.
Meat-watching?
No joy lies at the end of that rainbow. He has said back in his... Just don't do it. I know there's a natural curiosity now, and I cannot overstate, it will not... There's no pot of gold there. He said that back in his day, the Navy was, and I quote, "just like an English boarding school." But the thing is, English boarding schools are pretty gay places, Andy. Pretty gay. The only thing that could have made this even more perfect were if he'd had an extremely reactionary voting record on gay rights. That's the classic. But for that, you often need to cross the aisle for a classic page from the Social Conservative scandal textbook. Step forward this week, California Senator Roy Ashburn, a fierce opponent of gay rights who's battled for 15 years against gay rights laws in California. Last week, he, in a depressingly unsurprising development, was arrested for drunk driving as he left a gay nightclub with a male passenger in the car. He came out the next day during a radio interview saying, "I'm gay. Those are the words that have been so difficult for me to say for so long." And it's sad, Andy, that he had to feel this way. It's sad that he had to feel ashamed of his natural feelings. And it's sad that it's all the fault of people like him who demonise gays and lesbians by supporting laws of discrimination against them. He manages to be both victim and villain here. Last year, he opposed a bill to establish a day of recognition to honour gay rights activist Harvey Milk. What the f*** is wrong with this man? He helped on a daily basis make it difficult for gay people, like himself, to come out of the closet, which he was in. Presumably the best way of doing that is hoping that you get caught drunk driving away from a nightclub one day.
I think we have to look on the positive side here. He claimed that his votes against the gay rights legislation simply reflected the will of his constituents rather than his own personal lifestyle choices and what he described as his internal conflicts. And I think democracy needs more politicians who are public-spirited enough to see beyond their own self-interest. Now, admittedly, it would carry a little bit more authenticity if he had said he was gay whilst he was voting against the gay rights measures
right.
in an effort to grease up to his electorate, rather than waiting until he visited a gay nightclub en route to being arrested for drink driving with a man in the car. So I think his ethics rating, John, I don't know, naughty for me. whereas Massa, for me, I'd say his ethics rating is wonky.
Right.
I was fascinated by his relationship with Rahm Emanuel as well. He said he's the son of the devil's spawn.
Yes.
An individual who would sell his mother to get a vote. Mm-hmm. He would strap his children to the front end of a steam locomotive.
Well, I don't know what that would achieve.
Well, I'm not sure it's necessarily a bad thing either. Because most steam locomotives generally don't actually smash into stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably just letting his kids have a good view and a deeper understanding of the power unleashed by the Industrial Revolution. In many ways, it's education.
It's just a weird bargaining tool.
Yep.
Will you vote for the healthcare bill? I just don't believe in it, Rahm. I'm sorry. I just don't believe it is the right way forward for America. It's too expensive, and this is not the right idea that we have in place. Okay, okay. Would you vote for it if I strapped my children to the front of a steam engine? Ooh, Rahm. Ooh. Do you know what? I think I might.
What I would say, John, is let he who has never strapped his kids to the front of a train cast the first stone.
I'm not saying
anything. That's all I'm saying. I'm not passing judgment.
With these stories, Andy, you just wonder how much calmer America would be if some of its most repressed gay politicians just relaxed and started having sex and falling in love with other men. I feel like the whole country would improve overnight. We are that close to America being the country everyone wants it to be. Repressed congressmen just letting themselves be happy. Now, America is fantastic with sex scandals on both sides of the political aisle. We've had John Edwards and his love child, Governor Sanford and his Argentinian mistress, Governor Spitzer and his prostitutes, Mark Foley and his young boys, Larry Craig and his airport bathroom stall. But I still don't think anyone quite has the edge on British politician Stephen Milligan, who was way ahead of his time. The Conservative MP, who campaigned on family values, was found dead back in 1994 from autoerotic asphyxiation before Michael Hutchence made it fashionable, with a bin liner over his head, naked but for wearing stockings and suspenders, with an orange in his mouth. You got to go a long way, America, before you top that. It's the orange that takes it to a whole nother level.
Well, I guess you just wanted a shot of vitamin C. Is that wrong?
That's right. He was a fan of oranges. That is, for me, that is the standard by which sex scandals are now judged. If you're not found with a piece of citrus fruit in your mouth, just don't bother. Don't bother.
Well, here's another ethical thing, John. Carl Rove, the
yes.
three-time winner of the International Federation of Tools prestigious Dick of the Year mm-hmm. Award, has stated that he is, quote, proud that America used torture techniques when interrogating terror suspects. Now, he's basically not saying simply, we were right, it was a regrettable necessity. He's saying, shit yeah, we did it good. We're the greatest democracy in the world, the land of the free, and as such we are free to pretend to drown people, frighten them with insects, deprive them of sleep, because that is what freedom is all about. And again denied that waterboarding was torture, because the victims were checked out by a doctor who said they were fine, and because they were told they wouldn't drown. Which must have been some comfort as they were strapped down, had their faces covered and were doused to within an inch of drowning. I guess it's easy to forget that you'd been told you wouldn't drown whilst you are drowning. So I guess his ethics rating is dick.
Now, in terms of international ethical tornadoes, once again China is emerging as a force to be reckoned with. China plays very highly on the global corruption table, but it's unsure whether they're actually that corrupt or whether they just bribed someone to put them up there. And to combat this, the Communist Party, a party so long, Andy, synonymous with successfully and tirelessly battling corruption, has issued a new 52-point ethics code in an attempt to control growing corruption among Chinese officials. The code bans members from property speculation, money-making deals and lavish expenditure, and the last set of rules was issued 13 years ago. So, hold on here. Was this stuff not banned before? Because that seems like an almost willful oversight. And it must be very annoying to all the officials who've not been fleecing the system for the last 13 years, just naturally assuming that it might be against the law. I bet they feel stupid now.
Well, I think this is a throwback to the hardline days, John, because I guess then they didn't really need an ethics code, as tends to be the way with hardline communist autocracies. There was kind of an unwritten code, which was, you're doing something wrong. And if you're not doing something wrong, how come you're in this prison camp about to die? So that was kind of self-policing, I guess. 52 checkpoints on this ethics code, banning things like playing solitaire at work, also lavish weddings and lavish funerals and expensive overseas tours. So it does appear that the Chinese Communist Party is populated by celebrity pop stars.
In case you're wondering just how bad it is over there, a Chinese website, which was set up so that people could inform on corrupt officials, was inundated with so many visitors that it crashed shortly after launching. That is some indictment, Andy. Apparently, the website was designed to cope with a maximum of 1,000 people making a complaint at the same time, and it could not cope with the demand. There's no real way of finding a positive in that. It just looks bad. And one of the many complaints is that officials from China's southern Guangdong province are reported to have gambled away more than $3 million of public money in recent years. Apparently, 50 officials have been investigated. 6 have been jailed or punished for losing the money gambling at casinos in Macau, on cruise ships off Hong Kong, and betting on football matches. But here's the thing. Were they trying to keep those profits, or were they just trying to double the budget? Because that's different. People might get behind a politician saying, look, all I'm suggesting is that we go big and put the entire yearly education budget on Foggy Knight, who's running at the 440. Come on, Foggy Knight! Come on, Foggy Knight!
But it's basically what they've done with the bank bailouts, only with horses.
Exactly.
And as Richie Beno, the wisest man in the world, says, never bet on anything that can talk. So you're better off betting on a horse than a banker.
Israel news now, and if you're thinking, where did that peace in the Middle East go? We had it a couple of millennia ago, can't seem to find it anywhere. Then I'm afraid I have bad news for you. The search continues. As always, all sides are generally doing the opposite of helping, and this week it was Israel's turn to do something which makes the rest of the world slump down in their chairs and say, really? You just did that, did you? Really? Well, thanks a bunch. This time, Israel decided to announce that it plans to build 1,600 new homes in disputed East Jerusalem. And they decided to announce this during Vice President Biden's trip to the region, which he could fairly interpret as being greeted off the plane by a little girl with some flowers, who then proceeds to kick him in the balls. And Interior Minister Eli Yishai, whose office ordered the new homes, apologised for the timing of the announcement, coinciding with Biden's visit, saying, I'm very sorry for the embarrassment. Next time, we need to take timing into account. So that cleverly managed to both not apologise for the building plan itself and also to guarantee that there would be a next time. Look out, Biden. That little girl's back for another nutshot.
Yeah, apologising for the poor timing is a bit like Jack the Ripper sending a little telegram to the relatives of his victim saying sorry for making a mess of their clothes.
Biden responded by condemning the Israeli announcement and pointedly arrived 90 minutes late to a dinner with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, that's got the message across. Oh. You tell him, Joe! Oh. You tell him!
We're playing hardball now. I bet that really brought some comfort to the Palestinians in Gaza. Finally, justice was done. The Israelis were forced to fill up on breadsticks.
Joe Biden went on hunger strike and didn't eat his starter. That's how passionate he was. But I guess, John, this whole question comes back to the fact that God said it was ours. And
Right. You know, I mean, God, it's always simpler when you put it like that, Andy.
That's it. I mean, you know, you can argue with the planning department, but unfortunately that planning department is situated behind a tank. Well, maybe let's just ask the man who has caused this these disputes. Let's ask Almighty God himself. God, thank you very much for coming on the Bugle. No, the pleasure's all ours. So how have you been? Oh, really? At your age, too. Wow. Ouch. Ooh. Yeah, that must be tricky. I understand. Yeah. Can we just move it on? So what do you think should be done about the Middle East? God? I think the signal's gone. Sorry, was I the only one who could hear that conversation? I need to see my exorcist again.
All I could hear during that was Tom breathing. And I was thinking, holy shit, what have we done?
I am God.
I know he has the certain godlike powers, but that would really be a turn-up for the books. We turn up on Judgment Day and it's Tom saying, I would let you into heaven if you hadn't overrun so many times. Now burn in hell.
So it's time in the special ethics edition for the Bugle official ethics code. It's about time, having been talking at you now for 2.5 years, Buglers, that we tell you how we think you should live your life. So this is the Bugle Ethics Code. Point one, the Bugle believes people have a right to live, so please don't murder anyone whilst listening to the Bugle. Mm-hmm. Point two, the Bugle believes in being considerate towards our fellow human beings, even non-Buglers, so please don't victimise non-Bugle listeners with a public hate campaign featuring daubing offensive and libelous graffiti over their house and car, or hounding them in the street chanting abusive slogans at them. Point three, the Bugle believes in sharing with others less fortunate than ourselves, so please don't play the Bugle loudly on public transport unless you are prepared to repeat the show verbatim for your fellow passengers. And the Bugle also believes that women should be allowed to vote, but they should have to bring their own ballot paper and pencil. They've been relying on state handouts for too long. And finally, the Bugle believes fundamentally and passionately in the right of people to appear in whatever films they want to appear in,
yes,
regardless of the quality.
Absolutely.
Of the script.
That is important. If that's the only thing you live by, you cannot judge people. That's very important. Hypothetically speaking, maybe they go into projects, you know, with all good intentions, Andy.
Right.
No, that's never really thought about in these, yep, situations.
Yeah.
So that is a very good point.
Right.
Yeah, that's what the Bugle fervently believes that. Nobel nominee news now. That's a lot of alliteration. Now, after last year's ridiculous announcement of President Obama as winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, a record list of 237 individuals and organisations have been nominated for the prize this year, 2010. Wow, Andy, there sure must be a lot of peace in the world to merit 237 nominees.
Loads of it. I trod in some on the way to record this, didn't I?
Just everywhere.
Just all over the pavement. I feel a bit ashamed that we haven't been nominated. Michael Vick's on it.
Yeah.
He's been nominated, yeah, the American footballer, for setting a heroic example of redemption for the world by not being involved in an illegal dogfighting ring for over 3 months.
Yeah, good for Michael.
So he's shown that we can all change our ways.
Yeah.
Included in these 237 nominations is the internet. Nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, parts of the internet, fine. Other parts, not entirely peaceful. But if it wins, it will be the first non-human winner of the Nobel Peace Prize since Henry Kissinger. Wham, bam! Thank you, ma'am!
All you would need to do is look through some of the internet's message boards and see the opposite of these there. More personal declarations of war. I will cut your head off if you try and criticise Miley Cyrus again.
I think within 10 years, a full-blown world war will have started that began as a message board argument over whether or not Andy Murray's got what it takes to win a Grand Slam tournament.
The internet's nomination has been championed for helping advance dialogue, debate and consensus. It would certainly be the first time that you could have someone win both the Nobel Peace Prize and the Best Pornographer of the Year in the same year. That's not happened before, since Boutros Ghali.
The statement does describe the internet as a tool for peace, and undoubtedly is, if by peace you mean pictures of men's womble-tonks thrabbling women's palookadooks. from an ethics point of view, John, the internet has unleashed a krakatoa of sub-ethical practices.
Uh-huh.
I think it's also probably led to a re-evaluation of exactly how many deadly sins there are. I think it is certainly considerably above 7. Just the irritating things like this one, this email I got this morning telling me to secure my bank account details due to suspicious activity in my accounts and that my account would be suspended unless I clicked here. But do you know the funny thing about that, John?
What?
I don't even have an account with that bank. Why were they so worried about me?
I mean, I think you should just be safe, Andy, and click there. Just don't live a life of regrets.
Right, OK. Well, I thought I'd be safe and just burn all my cash in a big bonfire.
It's unclear, also, who exactly would accept the prize if the internet were to win. And I think it should either be you, Andy, or the guy who sang Chocolate Rain on YouTube. It's a toss-up. Maybe you should just accept it together.
It's not a coincidence, John, is it? Think about it. The Bugle starts on the internet late in 2007. 2.5 years later, bang, the internet gets a Peace Prize nomination.
Yeah.
Yeah, that cannot be coincidence. Because, I mean, think about it. If we hadn't been routinely puncturing Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's ballooning self-esteem with our waspish satirical barbs, he would almost certainly have nuked the entire planet by now.
Yeah, we've done a lot of good.
Who would have thought a humble podcast could save the human race?
Yep.
Well, that's what people said about Jesus. A saviour? Whimsical storyteller with a sideline and mid-range magic tricks, more like. And I'm not saying we're like Jesus, John. I'm just saying the majority of the world doesn't believe we were the Messiah.
Right.
Bugle feature section now, and a betrayal section to mark Tom jumping hemisphere and going to work for another media organisation. It was like Johnny Damon leaving the Red Sox to join the Yankees, or Sol Campbell signing for Arsenal for Spurs all over again. What can they give you that the Bugle can't, Tom? Apart from not having to stay up till 3 a.m. listening to two guys crap on about shit, and then cut out all the racist, heterophobic and anti-Buddhist bits. Plus a regular income, decent hours and people to work with who don't live 12,000 miles away. What else can they give you?
It's like Sol Campbell, £100,000 a week.
Sorry, I've got that. It was supposed to be a farewell section. We've agreed to save the betrayal section until next week when Tom isn't here anymore. My mistake. That's how these things work.
Judas! This is it, Andy. The great ship Tom is setting sail. And this will go down as one of history's great farewells, like Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman at the end of Casablanca. I think you're Ingrid Bergman in that analogy, Tom, which is no bad thing to be.
Well, I look just like her.
Yeah. Well, you don't look unlike her.
Oh, the Queen Mother, another great farewell. There was a massive protest against her death. Remember, millions of people on the streets of London.
Yeah.
I think it was a protest, anyway. Nelson at Trafalgar, his famous last words, cheerio, then lose us, I'm out of here. And Tony Blair, of course, when he bid farewell to Britain and told us we were the greatest country in the world. Which I think the stats don't necessarily back up.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not forget, he was hounded out of office for being massively unpopular. That was a bit like a comedian who has died on his arse telling the crowd they've been great, if I may delve into my own personal experience.
You're telling me that I'm massively unpopular?
No, not at all. Actually, have you selected your last words yet, Tom, for what the last thing you're going to say on the Bugle?
I have, yeah.
Oh, well, let's look forward to that. I guess the way that the Bugle will change is that it's obviously not going to be the same, the Bugle, anymore without you, Tom. I'm just not sure there's going to be quite the same incentive to overrun if we know it's not going to have an impact on the enjoyment of your weekend.
Well, I'm enjoying the idea that I might be able to send you really annoying and abusive emails.
Oh, that's true! God, I didn't even think of that.
I'm an interested listener now.
I didn't even think of that. Now you could appear in the email section. That's fantastic.
But there have been a number of our listeners extremely distraught at your departure.
True.
This email came in from James Florey in Seattle, Washington, who writes on the subject, Tom the Scottish producer and the whale. Dear Andy and John, in order of proximity to the mind of God.
Well, there's a big drop-off there as well, I think.
It seems that Tom has incurred the wrath of God on the innocent township of Melbourne. God has hurled lemon-sized, brackets not lime-sized, but very specifically lemon-sized, according to the local newspaper, hailstones at the unfortunate city, pell-mell, born out of his anger at the emigrating producer. I believe that the citizens of Melbourne have no choice but to hurl poor Tom into the sea, knowing that God will send a massive fish to house Tom until he realises that his true destiny lies controlling the volume at the Bugle to prevent Andy from becoming absolutely corrupted by absolute power. Oh, God. I can still feel it in my hands. In time, when Tom's hard heart is softened, beaten to a pulp by the waves of fishy digestive juices, the fish will swim up the Thames and spew him gently into the streets of London, where he can reclaim his rightful title, Tom the Producer. It's the whole country of Australia has basically fallen to pieces since you arrived.
It has indeed, yes. Australia's internet security threat level has been raised by America since I've been here as well.
What, you sound... There's a weird sound coming off your phone. It actually sounds like you're inside a fish. There's another email for you here, Tom, from Brian O'Connor. The subject says, Farewell to Tom, Queen of Scots. And it says, Dear Andy, John and Tim. And then there's a little asterisk, and it says, Having abandoned Bugle listeners, Tom surrenders the right to have his name spelled correctly in emails.
Fine by me.
He says, This is the single greatest tragedy to befall the Bugle since and including its inception. Very good. I just have to wonder what you lot were thinking, creating a character solely to toy with the audience's emotions, then abruptly killing him off for no apparent reason.
Oh, no, it's like Michelle Dessler in 24 all over again.
He says, as an American, I'm only tangentially familiar with this Australia place that you speak of, so I will have to assume that Tom has in fact died and gone to a hellish alternate dimension where the only professional sports teams are rugby, cricket and soccer teams, where beer is watery echoes of lager, and where opossums of comical and frighteningly enormous proportions hop around on 2 feet and or steal money from American criminals.
What?
And dance to hip-hop music in a laughable attempt to steal money from well-intentioned parents. I'm not following this. Which will be a reference, oh, I get it, to the 2003 Tom O'Connell vehicle Kangaroo Jack. Certainly a horrible enough movie that John should have been involved in every phase of its creation. F*** you! Ooh. Listen, that is against Bugle ethics now. He goes on to say, this will certainly be a ratings disaster, forcing the writers to come up with clumsy, stilted way to reintroduce Tim before the audience turns to more emotionally resonant fare like professional wrestling or Eliminate. Sincerely, Brian O'Connor in South Korea. That's PS, good luck, Tim. So, there you go.
I guess it
is like where they recast... It was on Roseanne, wasn't it? Where the daughter came back and they didn't refer to it. It was just... Actually, it happened in Neighbours as well.
Yeah, it's happened several times.
Happened in Neighbours. Lucy yeah. in Neighbours came back. Yeah. Completely different actress walked in. No one said anything about it.
Happened to me as well. That's true. Came home from a completely different wife. Never explained, but it just got on with it. People are absolutely disgusted that you're leaving us, Tom. This comes from Steve in New York, who writes... Whatever happened to the isolation chamber, by which I assume he means the soundproof safe, instead of honouring his retirement for the Bugle, why can't you just put Tom in there for the rest of his life?
That's a great idea.
It's not like it's being used for anything else, unless the last guest you put inside, whoever that was, is still in there.
It's Kissinger. I think we still have Kissinger in there. We have the corpse of Henry Kissinger. Henry, Tom's coming in.
I'd assume that Bugle is like the Mafia. Once you join, you can never leave. Please don't prove me wrong.
It's like retiring a shirt in American sport. Well, we should retire the name Tom from producers now.
Well, that's good, because the replacement producer will be a man called Chris. And Buglers, be very kind to him, because I won't. I'll be emailing him and the Bugle lots of abusive emails.
So let's not hate Chris straight off the bat. Let's give him a chance.
Yeah.
Yes, he's not Tom. He's not trying to be Tom. Right? He's going to forge his own way in doing this.
That's right. Also, he edited my... he produced my... my cricket show that I did last year on British radio. So he's already been slightly broken by me pushing deadlines to the very point of shattering. I think we could snap him in a month, John. So that's it. That's it from Tom. It's just the rest of this week's show to go, and then he is no more.
What? He on the Bugle is no more. What, Andy? Do you know something that we don't?
He's no more.
Have you ordered a hit again?
Just saying I know people.
Uh-huh.
And you've crossed me.
That's not the first time you've said that, actually.
It's, I mean, it should be chilling, what you're saying, and it isn't. It just isn't.
I just can't pull it off. I can't. I don't think I've ever threatened anyone effectively in my life. Your emails now, and, well, we've just done some of them. So that's it. There were some excellent ones about people's stories of their favourite birds, their favourite bird flippings.
Oh, yeah.
Following on from the story of Matilda, my daughter, flipping the bird aged 6 weeks at John.
We should do those next week.
We'll do those next week, so do keep them coming in, and we will have a best of the best birds in history. So do keep sending them in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. I do think, though, I should just do this quick email from Tom in Loughborough, who writes, Zaltor the Merciless, brackets and John, I suppose. Just thought you might like to know I found a partially completed printout of the Bugle audio cryptic crossword in a folder full of much more important things. Needless to say, I finished that bad boy off, and if you don't introduce another one, I will f*** you up. Can we afford not to respond to that, John?
I don't want to be f***ed up, Andy.
Well, but have another cryptic crossword.
I'd rather be f***ed up than put everyone through that again.
The lamest radio feature in the world.
Yes. What, mate? You are fired! You are fired!
Good.
Bugle Sport now. As you know, on the show, we like sport when it turns mad. And there's nothing madder in world sport than Pakistani cricket, which has had another serious dose of the crazy virus this week. They have banned their two best batsmen indefinitely, essentially acting life bans for basically bickering like schoolgirls. They've banned two more seasoned internationals for a year. They've put another player on probation for trying to eat a ball during a match.
What?
That's what Shahid Afridi, the nuttiest cricketer on the planet, in a recent international, just put the ball to his mouth and basically put his mouth right around it as if he was trying to eat a large and tasty apple. Which is not within the laws of cricket. Was viewed as ball tampering. So this is, it is astonishing, John. Pakistani cricket lurches from one disaster to the next. And this sort of is a modern sporting version of the old Roman trick of decimation, in which one soldier out of 10 would be summarily executed in order for the surviving 90% to raise their games. Now, I don't know if this is going to have the desired effect in today's more sensitive workplace, whether for Pakistani cricket or anywhere else. You know, personally, if 10% of my colleagues were slaughtered in an efficiency drive, I think I'd consider applying for a transfer or just resigning to spend more time with my family. But thankfully, in Britain and many other countries, despite our Roman heritage, such practices are now generally outlawed or require some extremely inventive paperwork to cover them up. But in solidarity with its cricketing brother, Pakistani hockey has also spent the week dancing with Dr. Daft, because the entire national Pakistan hockey squad has reacted to its disappointing World Cup performance by spontaneously retiring, all of them en masse. Which is brilliant, John. In a way, this makes a refreshing change from defeated sports people droning on about how they can take a lot of positives from an abject humiliation. Just want to get back out on the field and put things right. Because Pakistan's hockey players, I mean real hockey, not hockey that you need to be in the Arctic Circle for, real hockey with grass and bendy sticks, well, wiggly stick, a stick with a bend on the end. Pakistan's hockey players, they've clearly mulled things over and taken not positives, but negatives away from their World Cup experience and decided that not only can they not get back on the pitch and put things right, but that they are irretrievable losers. And from the point of view of someone who has known little but ineptitude and failure in his own humble sporting efforts, I find this a comforting, even inspiring attitude for elite international sportsmen to take. Well done, Pakistan. You are always there when we need you. Well, that's about it for this week's Bugle. I've just got a quick forecast, John. I have to decide the title for my show that I'm going to do at this year's Edinburgh Fringe.
Oh, yeah.
This weekend.
Oh, boy.
What do you think it's going to be?
I think it's going to be I think it's going to be over 15 words.
Right. Any suggestions? I tell you, let's open this out. If any of you Bugle listeners have a decent show title idea for me, email it in.
Wow.
And if I get it in time and I like it enough, I'll use it.
Wow.
The Bugle at timesonline.co.uk.
That's a good contest, Dan. This is it, Tom.
This is it, yeah. Tom.
We can't put it off any longer.
I'm retiring from the World Cup of Satirical Podcast.
Yeah, from the group stages.
John, have you got any final words for Tom?
Well, do you know, I was thinking as you were talking before, I realised I've never fired anyone in my life, and right. this is a great opportunity. Yeah. So I'll simply say this: you're fired, Tom. You are fired.
On what grounds?
On the grounds that you're leaving.
No,
I'm not ready for you to go.
John, it's not you, it's me. Well, actually, it is you.
It's me. Yeah, I knew it was me.
In the words of John Paul Richter, man's feelings are always purest and most glowing in the hour of meeting and the hour of farewell.
Wow, Andy. Is there anything you want to say, Tom?
Well, hey yep. Thank you, Andy and John.
Tom too?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Tom, yeah. You're fired!
There you go. You see?
That's outrageous.
You've hurt Paul too. You are fired, Tom.
He built a new studio for you.
That's right, and you've walked away. You're fired.
I built a brand new studio with fresh lines all the way to Melbourne
yes.
for you.
Yes, he's pulling a Donald Trump. You are fired.
I'm just adding Paul's email address to the list of abusive emails that I sent.
Any final words to the Buglers, Tom?
Thank you, Buglers, for making the Bugle so much fun. The emails and the blog entries.
Hey, you! It was us that made it fun.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul. Thank you to Tony Kibbles and all the people at News International who have helped. It makes it. And there's something else I seem to be forgetting.
It's like the Oscars.
Thank you, John and Andy.
Oh,
hey.
It has been great, guys.
You're rehired. You're back next week.
It has been absolutely brilliant fun, but I have one last thing to say to both of you.
Yeah.
John.
Yeah.
You. Andy. You.
Oh, I love it. I'm tearing up. I'm flipping you the bird, Tom. You can't see it. That's it. That's the end of Tom.
In response to your you, I will repeat the quote from John Paul Richter. Man's feelings are always purest in the hour of farewell. So that's it. This special ethics edition of the Bugle was brought to you in association with Kalashnikov, the rifle you can't stifle, the new Vatican Automobiles, Confessor Car, part all-terrain family vehicle, part confession booth, pollution with absolution, comes with a catalytically converted priest. Also in association with Oil Vey, a Jewish pressure group campaigning for fairer redistribution of petroleum profits, and Mines a Pint, a new charity that encourages insurgents the world over to exchange their landmines for a nice cleansing pint of real ale. Bye-bye, Buglers.
What a joke to go out on. Bye, Buglers. Goodbye and good luck, Tom.
Bye, guys. Bye, Buglers.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again.
Dry your eyes, boys.
Sunny day.
For the best in sport, comedy, science and books, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.